Imagine being a part of a large group of people, all with differing points of view, socioeconomic beliefs, and backgrounds. Now, imagine you are asked to discuss a variety of issues, such as economy, the environment, and immigration. In September of 2019, a total of 526 registered American voters were brought together to discuss important issues that impact all of us. Participants were respectful, addressed each talking point more objectively, and simply approached these issues as individuals who are being impacted by them daily. These are the voices of America in one room.
I don't want to go back to feeling ignorant or feeling that I'm not able to speak to this at all.
I've never talked to anybody who was staring down poverty.
When you come in and you're so angry and so negative, nothing good can come from that.
Walked into a room with a bunch of people who didn't share my opinion and didn't come from anywhere near the same place.
Welcome to Voices of America in One Room. My name is Alice. I'm the Associate Director at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University. Welcome to Voices of America in One Room. My name is Alice, and I'm the Associate Director at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University. In this episode of Voices of America in One Room, we sit down with thought leader Daniel Lebetsky, founder and executive chairman of Kind. As a philanthropist, Daniel is passionate about building bridges between people, and it's his mission to create opportunities for people to recognize their shared humanity. We are honored that Daniel was able to take time out of his busy schedule to discuss the issues that America in One Room was centered around. In this episode of Voices of America in One Room, we sit down with Daniel and we talk about a range of issues currently impacting all of us.
Alice, it's a real pleasure, both because I love Stanford, I love Stanford Center for Deliberative Democracy, but also I'm very, very impressed with the work that you guys have been doing, and I'm very honored to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, it's a privilege for me to be talking to you. And I'm going to dive right in here. I saw your op-ed from the earlier this year, and it was a very passionate article about the dangers of extremism and how it exists on the left and the right. And you pointed out that really it's leaving this gap in the middle, and it's growing bigger and bigger, discouraging people from paying attention. And I would just love to hear more from you about why you think this is happening.
Well, first I'll start by summarizing the point I shared in that article, which is something I've observed over the last 20 plus years where I've done work for peace in the Middle East and across the world. I was, you know, born in Mexico City. And something that I've noticed is extremism as a mindset is very dangerous and corroding and metastasizes to ultimately catch up with its host. And that's the insight that I shared in the article, that if you have an extremist mindset, you originally think you're just against that quote unquote other that might be an external or foreign force, but eventually that mindset ends up harming you in your daily life and harms whoever coddles extremism as a mindset ends up ultimately receiving extremism within their own home. And I shared examples of how the Saudi kingdom for a while was trying to do a relationship with Wahhabism that in order to keep them satisfied, encouraged madrasas to teach very extremist dogma. And it ultimately caught up with them to the point that even, you know, Al-Qaeda didn't just find satisfaction with attacking Americans. Then Al-Qaeda felt that the Saudis were not holy enough, and eventually society within the Saudi kingdom was further divided within itself, within the Sunni and Shia groups and within people that were for and against the monarchy, but with extremism that was intolerant and that was hateful. And I provide examples from experiences that I had in Germany, from experiences that I had in Israel, experiences that I had in Mexico, where I've seen it. And then in the United States, it caught up with us, where I have been noticing this move towards it over the last many years. And when you think that extremism can serve your own agendas and you're like, okay, well, you know, Trumpism in this case, you know, he's at least advancing our agenda and awakening our base. But ultimately, it ended up with January 6th, where people were coming after Mitch McConnell and Vice President Pence and others who had basically done this deal with the devil of extremism. And the same thing happens on the left. You know, there's many, many examples of our society being so corroded by cancel culture and by the inability of people to listen to one another, that then ultimately that intolerance catches up with it. And, you know, one of the things that's amazing about America is our ability to be critical, empathetic thinkers. What does that mean? Critical thinkers means that you really question things and the marketplace of ideas wins. And empathetic thinkers is that you give people the benefit of the doubt and you assume that they have positive intent when they speak. And we're losing a lot of that.
That is a really great point. The critical thinking and engaging with others is certainly something we were trying to do in America in One Room. And I would love to know from you, how do we communicate to people that we need to have critical thinking and we need to engage with people that are different from us? How do we get out of this tribalism that you talk about?
It's not easy at all, because the very same dynamics that create this challenge make it hard to communicate it. Like, people tend to wake up when things are really, really, you know, when the house is burning and then you wake up. But when things are okay, the nature of moderates and of centrists is that, you know, when an extremist wakes up in the morning, they think, how can I advance my cause? And when a moderate wakes up in the morning, they think, what can I have for breakfast? And that fundamental tension in motivations explains a lot of the challenges that we have. Because actually, people with extremist mindsets historically have less of a dominance in our society, at least in terms of percentages of the population, but they are overrepresented in most parts of society because they are passionate. And people that are moderate and thoughtful and temperate, they're not as passionate about this stuff and they don't give as much of themselves. And so it's only when we realize and wake up and say, wow, we cannot take democracy for granted, that we ultimately get shaken into action. It shouldn't be that way. We need to recognize that democracy is fragile and it's a gift that we've been given, along with rule of law, respect for one another, taking care of one another. These are American values that when I came from Mexico, I found amazing. And we shouldn't take for granted that a comedian can criticize the president and not go to jail. In many other countries, that comedian would go to jail. We shouldn't take for granted that nobody is above the law, and that if the head of state does something unlawful, they should face the consequences. Again, in the vast majority of countries, we do not have such a robust system of laws. And America is definitely not perfect. We have a lot of work to do to heal it, but it's pretty damn good relative to most other countries. And so we need to preserve it, safeguard it, and recognize that we have the power as individuals to do something about it. And with that power comes the responsibility to be active citizens, and starts with baby steps about how we conduct ourselves in our daily lives.
I want to dive a little deeper into the moderates. You're on the point that, you know, they're not as passionate as people that are on the extremes. And one of the participants shared that she's fairly, you know, moderate and a little bit more conservative. But what she found was that social media was turning her away and it was reverting her back. Because after America in One Room, she said that she was open, she was engaged, and she wanted to get out there. and get her opinions out there. But as she saw the different voices from the extreme coming in from left and right, it just shut her down.
Historically, we have the problem, right, that I shared about extremism versus moderation. Then you add to that that over the last several decades, there's been an atomization of traditional media sources. You can get cable one way or the other. And, you know, it tends to start catering to one audience or the other audience. And for ratings purposes, they want to cater to the audience. And people start getting information about affirming their beliefs rather than informing their beliefs. Mm-hmm. But then comes social media. And there's a couple of very serious challenges with it. Number one, by its nature, it is fomenting sensationalism because the stuff that travels best with these algorithms is the most provocative, sensationalistic stuff. That's what people are forwarding. And so it's their business model is encouraging more extremist discourse because the more extremist the discourse, the more that they're going to get clicks, the more that they're going to make money. It is extraordinarily dangerous. Then you add to that the algorithm that gives you what you want to hear, because again, you're going to stay there longer. So it's, you know, getting what you want of the most sensationalist type. And then you add the lack of liability, because at least Fox News and CNN and Wall Street Journal or New York Times, there are boundaries. They can be sued if they publish stuff that is demonstrably false and defamatory. And media has a ton of space to operate. You know, American freedoms are, and freedom of speech are very, very vast. So the media has plenty of protections. But at some point, if you're affirmatively and demonstrably disseminating lies that are harming a person under certain circumstances, you can be held accountable, because even that, you know, if it's a public persona, the media has a ton of leeway, but at some point, you know, you can be held accountable. That doesn't exist on social media. On social media, we have created these blanket protections. And I think we need to amend Section 230 to ensure that we still have a robust marketplace of ideas, but to ensure that there's also a sense of responsibility. Because it's liberty, not like libertinage. It's like we need to make sure that we instill in all of these platforms a sense of responsibility to not disseminate demonstrably false information.
And I know that you yourself have been working a lot in examples you gave. And I don't think a lot of listeners know actually that you're so involved and so passionate in these areas. I just wanted to stop and talk a little bit more about what you're working on now. I would love to know more. You know, I'm sure you're working on a ton of projects at the same time. Are there any you could share with us of what you're doing right now and hope to do in the near term?
Sure. Let me, by way of background, tell me how I got here, because it'll make most sense. But
yeah,
I was born in Mexico City. My mom was born in Mexico, but her parents immigrated before the war. My dad was born in Europe, and he was in a concentration camp in Dachau, liberated by American soldiers, and then eventually ended up in Mexico. So a lot of my upbringing and a lot of my attitude about life is from having been taught by my mom and dad of the importance of building bridges to prevent what happened to my dad from happening again to any other human being. Mm-hmm. And when I first came to the United States, if you had told me back then in 1984, when I immigrated to US, there will be one day where you want to build those bridges here in the United States because democracy and respect and empathy and the social fabric that underpins the greatest democracy to have ever existed are under threat, I would say, I think you're a little cuckoo. And in fact, you know, the last 26 plus years since I graduated from Stanford Law School, I spent my time building bridges outside. And so I had ventures. One of them is called Peaceworks, which brought Israelis, Palestinians, Jordanians, Egyptians, Turks through one venture Sinhalese Tamils and Sinhalese and Tamils in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia, a women's cooperative where Muslim, Christian, and Buddhist women were making sauces, in South Africa, in Mexico, in Chiapas. I tried a bunch of ventures. If anything, I tried too many ventures and I wasn't sufficiently focused. Out of that came KIND, and KIND was born with a view towards trying to foster kindness and empathy within the United States, and where I started the business. And then I also created a movement called One Voice, which tried to build a human infrastructure of moderates in the Middle East to try to give Israelis and Palestinians and other international citizens that wanted to end the conflict and achieve peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors, a platform for their voices to be amplified and heard. And again, if you had told me that any of these things were going to come useful in the United States, I would have probably not believed you 5 years ago. But I actually find them desperately needed and fascinatingly useful. Like, a lot of these things that we learned about how to help people recognize common ground are now applicable here in the United States. As an example, Alice, in the early 2001, 2002, I used to go around Israeli cities and Palestinian cities talking to friends and colleagues and asking them, you know, what do you think about these principles that was formed by a council of experts? And they were principles on how to move forward to try to end the conflict. And almost without a fail, Israelis would say, of course, this sounds amazing. I agree with everything you wrote, but you're wasting your time. And like, why am I wasting my time? Because you're not going to get one single Palestinian to sign this document. They're just not going to accept these principles. The same identical document that I would take to my Palestinian friends and say, what do you think about this document? They would read it carefully and say, wow, I agree with everything you wrote. It's great. It's really well written. But you know what? It's a waste of time. Why? Because you're not going to get one single Israeli to agree on these principles. And they were the identical principles, Alice.
Right.
And we went out and we signed up hundreds of thousands of Israelis and Palestinians and showed them that there was a lot of hidden common ground and that on values we could agree. So we need to do the same thing in America, because we right now have a situation where people prefer that their daughter or son marries someone from a different religion or ethnicity or nationality over different party affiliation. Like, it is scary that we are othering. And you know, there are valid, deep concerns on both sides, but at some point we need to bring back the ability to respectfully disagree, to assume positive intent, and to be more constructive and critical thinkers and listeners. Mm-hmm. We cannot, and it is not going to be easy. I mean, I'm engaging in conversations every day with dear friends that I disagree with, and I go crazy. Drives me nuts that my friends are like sometimes accepting conspiracy theories, or, you know, they're, you know, you can have your own opinions but not your own facts. But today everybody has their own facts. It is, but it is absolutely necessary that we engage in these conversations and figure out ways to counteract this growing trend towards intemperate, extremist, uncritical acceptance of whatever your echo chamber is giving you.
Daniel, I want to dig a little deeper. You mentioned your friends and family that disagree with you. How do you handle it? How are you engaging in dialogue with them to get them to think about what your side, or how are you thinking about where they are and where they're getting for their information? How do those conversations usually end?
Well, I have a very close friend that I interestingly have gotten closer to, even though he drives me nuts on these issues. And it's interesting because I suspect he gets the same thing that I get out of it. And so this is a very smart guy. This is not, you know, an uninformed person, but he and I engage every day on primarily conversation through a chat platform. And we each try to convince each other about our perspective. It primarily revolves around Trumpism, which I think is extraordinarily dangerous. I am not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm a very proud independent. and I read Einstein's biography by Walt Isaacson, and was so pleased to hear that smarter people than me feel the same way, that partisanship is very dangerous because it just basically blindly turns you to be blindly loyal to someone from your party just because they're in your party, even if their ideas or their actions are wrong. But I am a firm anti-Trumpist in the sense that I think that Mr. Trump engaged in incitement towards violence, and I could spend hours walking through all the things that he did wrong. But he does not believe that. And he actually thinks that Democrats are going to destroy America with socialist tendencies and anti-Semitic strains. And he thinks that Democrats are bureaucratic and big government, and that they are disrespectful and cancel culture and wokeism. And, you know, sometimes he has valid points. You know, Democrats sometimes push people away because they are sometimes arrogant or self, they are preachy, and they don't respect that somebody might have a different perspective from yours. And I have a non-scientific assumption that a not insignificant amount of Trump supporters, I don't know if it's 10% or more, hang on to him because he speaks up against wokeness and cancel culture. And they wish they could do that, but they feel intimidated to speak up when they disagree on an issue. And consequently, they're going to stand by this guy no matter what, because he fights their fights. And my response to him is like, look, you know, you do have a valid point, but a wrong messenger, like, man, like, what a wrong, this is not the solution. And in fact, it's going to backfire more, because it's going to bring, you know, the Republicans into nativism. And then if the Democrats don't have a counterforce to keep them in the center, they too will continue moving. They will have no force to bring them to center. They're going to continue moving to the extreme. And I think both Democrats and Republicans have to remember that the overwhelming majority of people are tempered, moderate human beings, even with the advent of social media, would like, you know, a little bit more respect, a little bit more dialogue, and a little more understanding. I wish I could tell you that my conversations with my friend have changed his mind. I think maybe, you know, if he was at a 0 to 100, 100 is Trump is my hero and 0 is Trump is evil, maybe he's at 80, which is huge ground. And he acknowledges that Trump did a lot of bad things, but then he thinks that I and others exaggerated, and that January 6th was nothing, and that it was the same as the social protests and stuff. But, you know, I grow a lot from my conversations with him. I understand things better, and I listen, and it's very painful, Alice. It is so hard when he forwards me links from, you know, sources that I find questionable and speakers that I find pathetic for their lack of integrity. And I think they're just being populist, nativist, and they should know better. You know, Ted Cruz as an example of like someone that I find, because the guy's smart. The guy's very smart. And he's just a politician through and through, not a leader, he doesn't care about truth. He cares about power. Mm-hmm. And that stuff is very dangerous. But we have that on the left, center, and right. People that put their political popularity above truth. And it's, but it's important to listen to the things that he sends me. So, you know, we kind of have a kind of an agreement where I send him stuff that sometimes he ignores and I ignore, but at some point say, okay, I need you to read this one. Like, okay, which one are you going to read? And we kind of like each read each other's stuff. And it's really important to, you know, I try to go on a bunch of sources and not stay only on one set of sources, but it's very hard because it's painful to watch stuff that you think is lies. Mm-hmm. But then if you don't do it, you're not going to really understand the other side.
That last sentence or the last thought you shared is so important, because so many of us have family members and friends that, you know, we may not agree with, and making the effort to look at things that we know we'll disagree with will really help us understand what other people are thinking. And I think, you know, we talk about, you know, myself included, you know, opening up different websites and, you know, videos and channels to watch, but like you, it's hard. And I think, you know, we have to schedule it on our calendar to do it in order to make it happen.
With a proviso that the other party needs to want it too. Like I find these debates to be healthy, and I find them annoying sometimes, but I grow from them and I learn a lot from them. So this friend of mine, I think similarly, I drive him nuts sometimes, he drives me nuts sometimes, but we're learning from each other and we both get a lot out of it. I have situations with family members that said, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I just don't want that in my life. So you can't force that on them. And so you need to also respect space. The irony is that sometimes they say, I don't want to talk politics, but then the next hour they send me their version of what they say is not politics, but it's very much politics. I'm like, okay, which is it? If you want to just share pictures of our children, that's fine. If you want to talk about politics, then we need to find a respectful discourse. I think in general, it's healthier if you have the ability to talk about these issues than if you shut them out. I don't think it's healthy if you have to shut them out. But, you know, at some point, if your family member doesn't want that, my relationship with them is more important. Sure. And I will respect that.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of strands. I have Republican leaders that I admire a lot, sadly not in the majority today, but I engage in communications with them and they influence me and I influence them and we have an exchange of ideas, and some are a lot more moderate than others. Some are more hawkish, but, you know, I find myself more and more leaning towards only supporting Democratic candidates, even though I'm an independent. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it's healthy for Democrats or for America that the Republican Party be hijacked by nativists, just like I don't think it would be healthy for the Democrats to be hijacked by the far extreme left. I think all, and by the way, there's a role for the more progressive at all costs left and for the conservative at all costs right. I think all of them play a role, and you want to create the space for people that have incredibly progressive, perhaps overly idealistic, and in my opinion, sometimes unrealistic, but laudable ideals and values to have a voice, as long as they also respect that people from the center might also have a voice and people from the right might also have something to contribute. My friend John Mackey from Whole Foods, you know, he talks about different groups and that there are people that are at all costs, I'm mangling how he, the groups that he frames it into, but, you know, there are people that think that they're progressive and they just believe in progressive values. They're conservative people that just believe in conservative values. They're postmodernists that just believe in postmodern values. And there's what he calls, I think, integrationalists, where they basically take a little bit from each of them. And I think I belong to that one. There are some progressive values that I really admire. And I think our society would be hurt if we didn't preserve some of those, you know, goalposts. And there's some conservative values that I really, really care for and admire, and even some libertarian values that I really connect with. I personally, ultimately, am very much a person that finds temperance and balance and moderation to be the most valuable. And so I like to learn from all sides, and I like to find that common ground. And even within moderation, there needs to be moderation. You know, if you have a situation that calls for action, you can't always just explain things away and just be moderate. Sometimes you need to stand up and fight for something. You know, you shouldn't be a moderate when you're fighting with the Nazis in World War II. You need to stand up and fight them. So I'm not a pacifist. But for the most part, I think the overwhelming majority of human beings, and I don't mean 90%, I feel like 98 or 99 or 99.5%, are people that go to sleep at night thinking that they're good human beings and that they're doing the right thing and they want to make this a better world for the children. And so you need to find a way through that vehicle of making this a better world for our children. That's how you build that bridge for us together to do so.
Daniel, that was really great, and I'm really grateful for your thoughts. And I want to talk a little bit more.
Wait, Alice, I didn't tell you what we're going to do. You asked me and I went into this long diatribe.
Okay.
I just realized I didn't answer your question.
Yes. What are you planning to do?
We're going to do what we did there here, trying to encourage common ground and moderation and listening and critical, empathetic listening. And then we're going to take a lot of what we learned through Peaceworks and use business as a force for bringing people together and invest in communities where people of differences are committing to strive to coexist and work together with one another.
Actually, my next question was about how to be kinder and more empathetic. I was hoping to get some advice from you. You know, we can't always have events like America in One Room, and the efforts that you are leading now will likely impact certain communities. But how do we get everyone to be kinder and to be more empathetic? What are those daily small things we could have people do?
I do think it starts with all of us monitoring how we're absorbing news, how we're handling our human interactions with others. Again, living in a day and age where devices have invaded us so much. How are we looking at people in the eyes? How are we striving to try to be better listeners? Are we at least once a day going in to read one article that we disagree with? And are we feeling a little bit of discomfort when we're reading the news? If we're not, we're probably just affirming our beliefs. We're not informing our beliefs. We need to understand what is going on, how it's going on, how people are perceiving it. Not because you want to be convinced by the other side, because you want to persuade the other side. If you are listening to them, you're going to be more effective at being able to come from their perspective and put yourself in their shoes and be more effective. Approach things with more empathy. And, you know, I will just want to be clear that I am as imperfect as they come. And I, you know, I'm a confused Mexican Jew. So a lot of temperament, and sometimes I get very passionate and I mess up. And, you know, I need to, with my children, with my wife, with my friends, with my family, with my team members, be aware of that and then just try to improve on that. And I think it's the intent, it's the conscious awareness to try to be more thoughtful. Like one exercise that I started doing that I find really, really provocative to share with my friends is, over the last year, has there been anything of substance that you've changed your mind on? Has anything or anyone, any new data point come into your life that has caused you to say, oh, I was wrong on this person, or I was wrong on this issue, or I was wrong on this assumption? And it's very hard to say, yeah, let me give you examples. And it's hard because by the nature of the exercise, you need to go back and think. But it's hard because we don't do enough of it. We really probably are much more hanging on to our beliefs, that we use all sorts of media to rationalize, to make it consistent with our preconceived thoughts. And that's not the way that you're going to build the best companies. That's not the way that you're going to raise the best children. That's not the way that you're going to build the best society. For you to do that, you really need to encourage true critical thinking and to question assumptions and to think more openly.
I struggle to think about something that I disagreed with in the last year, or I learned differently. I mean, the point you brought up, do you feel discomfort at any point in the day with any news you're reading or ideas? That one is really hard. And we definitely have to venture out to make ourselves.
It's very hard. It's very hard because I also don't want, you know, to encourage people to be going to places that are selling BS and conspiracy theories.
Right.
And like, there is something called truth. But if we think that the media that we're absorbing is completely unbiased, we're wrong.
Yeah,
All media has some bias. So it's important for you. Okay, so if you're in this thing, then move a little, get a couple steps to the left and a couple steps to the right, or a little bit above. Try to just expand a little bit. I'm not asking you to go to, please don't go into cuckoo sites. Or if you go them to study them so that you can understand them, but don't get absorbed. But
really good advice. As I was preparing to talk to you, I came across a Father's Day post you wrote a few years ago. It was so touching and transparent about just your memories and lessons that your father taught you. And I, you know, sat there thinking, actually, what would his father think about the world it is today? And I wonder what you would think he would say and what advice he would have for us.
So this is very interesting. We're four children. My mom and dad had four kids. Every one of us has very different perspectives about what's going on.
Oh,
very
wow.
different perspectives. And if you asked each of us, I think all of us would agree that my dad would be sad about what's going on. And that would encourage probably the same values that I shared, but we disagree on the prognosis and on where this is coming from. So it's interesting that even among four siblings that were raised by by two very loving parents, we would probably have very passionate and hopefully respectful disagreements, but we run across the spectrum of perspectives. And I think that is an explanation of what our world is going through. My dad had the ability to see the good in people. I really do not remember instances where he wrote off a person. He was very forgiving and very empathetic. Like, his empathetic quotient to us, as high as they come. And I think we need more of that. I think on the left and on the right, we need to assume positive intent. We need to assume that people are trying to, you know, make this a better world for their children. They think that what they're doing is right. And we need to stop assuming that the other side is evil, because it's not. I think there are some people and some manipulative politicians that manipulate people, and they tend to be in the extremes, but they're everywhere. But for the overwhelming majority of human beings, like my dad would teach you, you know, want to do the right thing. And my father used to talk to us about the Holocaust and tell us horrible stuff he went through. And he would, you know, I was marked as a kid hearing his stories as a 9-year-old, and it was overwhelming. And I think that till today is what drives me to try to prevent that from happening again tomorrow. But he also made sure to remind us of people that saved his life, that took courage in the darkness of times to show some humanity. And some of those people were not nice people. The story that most people ask me about is about this German soldier that threw a potato by my dad's feet when people were not watching. But there's a much more harrowing story about, do you have like a few minutes, Alice? We can say along, or should
of
we?
Of course, No, we have time.
There was a superintendent where my grandfather, grandmother, and my dad and his brother lived. So it were two boys and their mom and dad. And the superintendent once approached my father when my dad was a young kid. I don't remember if he was 9 or 11 years of age, somewhere along those lines. The war started when he was 9, and then by 11 and a half, he was in a ghetto. So somewhere between 9 and 11, he said, "Hey, are you hungry?" And my dad said, "Yes." And he said, "Come, I'll show you where there's some, there's some food for you to eat." And he took him a block away and he pointed him to a pile of dead bodies. And he said, "Here, those are Jews. You can take a piece of meat from one of them."
Oh my goodness.
My dad was a little kid, and this man did that to him. And then at some point later, the families were rounded up. The Jewish families were rounded up by paramilitary officers, and they talked to the superintendent, and he had them point them to every Jewish family. And they brought those Jewish families and they fusillated them. They killed them. And the last family that was left was my dad's family,
wow,
my grandfather's family. And the paramilitary forces went inside their apartment, mm-hmm, and they took my grandmother into another room and stayed with her for a period of time. And my dad at that point didn't understand what happened. You know, sometimes I don't get the facts perfect, but I encourage all of your listeners to go on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's an interview that I posted of my father where he, mm-hmm, talks about these issues directly.
Oh, wow.
His name is Roman Lubetsky, and it's available on YouTube. Wow. It's on my channel. But afterwards, they brought my family down where all the other Jewish families had been killed. And a few minutes before they got killed, the superintendent approached the paramilitary leader and whispered into his ear, and the paramilitary leader left. And the superintendent went to my grandfather and said, "You know what, Mr. Lubetsky, I just told them to leave you, and I spared you because every day you would look at my eyes and you'd say hi to me and you treated me with respect.
Oh.
And on the holidays, you'd give me my bottle of schnapps, wow, and you wish me a Merry Christmas and you treated me well. So I'm sparing you, but leave now before I change my mind." And that night they had to take their belongings and leave.
Wow.
This is the same person, mm, that was a monster.
Mm.
And Alice, to think that I am on this planet, mm, because a bad person, mm, showed humanity and spared my family. And it is such a complex thought. Every human being has the capability to have a modicum of humanity. And this, wow, man was not a good man. Like, he had other families killed and he did that to my dad. He was a nasty person. But he spared my family and I ultimately lived because my grandfather had treated him with kindness. And he returned, wow, it at that critical moment.
That is an unforgettable story you just shared. And honestly, I understand so much more of why you do what you do and why being kind and empathetic is in your blood. It's who you are.
Being kind and empathetic is my aspiration. Is, yeah, you know, I think it's in my dad's blood, but it's something all of us as human beings need to work,
yes,
for. But you're right. I mean, the more I think about and study myself, the more that these formative influences have an impact in, I'm not naturally always like, some people think that I'm just so quote unquote optimistic. It's more that I'm determined to prevent what happened to my dad, but I live with these concerns.
And I think at anyone listening to your story, your family's background, history, and everything that you have done and will do, will know that there is hope.
Absolutely, there's hope. There's hope in that individual, mm-hmm, that was treated with kindness and then behaved, yes, with kindness. And imagine, yes, if more people are kind to one another and more of us assume positive intent and more of us. And there's also, you know, the United States has survived. And so hopefully we'll come out stronger from him.
Yeah.
And we need to, at this point, reach out to one another and start rebuilding common ground. I listened to a talk by Ben Sasse, the senator, and I thought he was fantastic. And for me, he embodies what we need today. You know, he's going to continue having deeply conservative values. Nobody's going to take that from him. But he's also very principled, and he's also reaching out, and he's also encouraging that we reach out to the other and treat each other with respect. And I think there are plenty of inspirational figures today for us to rally behind. I just hope that on the left, center, and right, we will do that, because it's so much easier for the extremes to pander to you, and then you feel good about it because they're like, yeah, this is my issues. But at this point, we really need to elevate leaders that are going to to work with each other.
Daniel, you are definitely one of those inspirations. And I want to thank you so much for taking time out to share your stories, share your thoughts and advice with us. And I really hope that people that are listening will take your advice and do one thing a day that's either out of their comfort zone, do something nice, to know that that will make a difference.
Alice, I thank you for the very, very important work that you guys are doing. And I look forward to hopefully working with you guys.
Our thanks to Kind for helping us arrange our interview with Daniel Lubetzky. And thank you to Daniel for joining us. From the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University, Helena, NORC at the University of Chicago, and By the People Productions, this has been our final episode of Voices of America in One Room. If you like our series, please consider giving us a 5-star review and be sure to tell your friends to subscribe. This podcast is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Voices of America in One Room is hosted by me, Alice Hsu. To learn more about me, you can find me on the Center for Deliberative Democracy's website. Voices of America in One Room is produced by Jared Sanders and Scott Simpson. Our audio engineer and sound engineer is Josh Williams. This series is executive produced by the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University and Tobey Agency.